Hey now, good people, it is June the 1st. Wow, can you believe it? 6/1/21. That's right. Man, we are headed directly towards Juneteenth, aren't we? When we celebrate everything black about our lives and relish and appreciate it. Hey, let's keep that modus operandi going full-fledged ahead. Well, this is the holiday, right? Memorial Day. And I'd like to call this Army Out It. I think you like the story that I'm going to tell you and how poorly it made me feel way back in the day. But let's start off a little music with a group called the New Power Trio. And man, what a great... I saw this group play live and... down at LACMA a number of years ago, and it was John Crooks on the bass and Nate Shaw at the piano and Mark Suter on the percussion. Gonna play a number right now, number 4 on the album called, let's see if I can say it right, El Cortio de Tula. Ah, yes, and then I'll be back to tell you about that infamous day in Seoul, Korea, on Camp Corner 304th Signal Battalion, when the Army outed some people in a real classical way. Thank you for coming to my website today. Thank you. Nice. Yeah, that's a new power trio. You know, the day was, I don't exactly remember the day, but it was in 1966, I think around December, because it was around Christmas time. And I had been in Korea as a soldier just for a little bit. And it was harrowing for me because I was a young 21-year-old guy in a place where a bunch of other 21-year-old guys were. And I was blessed enough to be stationed in one of the finest cities in that part of the world, Seoul, Korea. And I was an American soldier in the Army in the 304th Signal Battalion. And I think I was Specialist 4th Class at that time. I had not been taken through a terrible time in my life when I was a pro-choice man. The story of Sergeant Rush, the racist white sergeant that came to the 304th Signal Battalion and fortunately found, let's see, it was Joe Foster and myself and a couple of other black guys in that battalion in B Company, radio teletype section, that were black. And I was up to getting my own truck and all that kind of stuff, being a radio teletype operator. I wasn't very smart on the job, but I was willing to learn. I would go out on field problems with, at that time, Sergeant Cap. I wonder if he's still alive. Man, I have these vivid memories. But while I was stationed there in Camp Coiner, RTT, Rough, Tough, and Tactical, Pret de Chore Pret, was our model in Latin, ready, always ready. Because I was in the 304th Signal Battalion, and we were a support command for the 8th Army. I was drafted in 1965, went through, training out of this world. Some of the best training that a soldier could ever get. And then sent to Seoul, Korea as a teletype operator. It was a dream job. But you had to be tested, and I tested high in the Signal Corps back there. I was gay. I didn't come out with it. No, you better not, back in the day. Survival was the key. Whatever you did, you had to survive. And at the time when I went into the Army, I'm being truthful, factual with everything, telling as much truth about this life as I know I could. I did not meet the woman that I was going to marry until after I got out of the Army. I never had a girlfriend because I've never been attracted to girls like that. Didn't have a boyfriend because at that time, if you like guys, you never talked about it. You never spoke about it because you knew that you would be ostracized, criminalized. I mean, man, it was rough being gay and being black at that time. And the gay guys that I knew, we didn't talk about it. We didn't have relations because at that time, I didn't know how. I was green. Think about it. I was in the Army. And this incident was fresh on my mind because it was around Christmas time. And a lot of the soldiers had weekend passes. They could leave the fort. And I didn't go out on a weekend pass. I had a couple. I could have gone out, but I didn't go out, simply put, because I had nowhere to go, no one to see, no money to spend. And at that time, if you were gay and if you were in the military, you didn't speak about it. It wasn't don't ask, don't tell. If you said anything, your life would go to hell. Just as simple as that. And so what did I do? Nope, didn't hang out, didn't have sex with anybody, didn't dare do that because we were too terrified to let practically anybody know that we were like that. And this story that I'm about to tell you about these two white soldiers, I don't know their names, but all I know is that they were army ousted as soon as it came to light. In the 304th Signal Battalion, I was stationed in B Company, and I was a radio teletype operator. And each hooch had its men stay in this Quonset hut. That's what it was. It was our hooch, and it was our Quonset hut. And it was during the time when Vietnam was killing American soldiers. We were dying all over the place during that time. And as a matter of fact, a couple of years after I went in, my brother was drafted. And the way he told me is that the entire graduating class that he graduated from Fremont with, they all went over with the, I think it was 125th Artillery Division. And he said most of them were massacred over there, just killed. They never survived going to Vietnam. My brother did. He's very ill today, to tell the story right. And I love for him to talk about it, but it's difficult for him, as you would presuppose, to talk about his life during that day. Just like it would be difficult for gay guys to talk about what we went through. But this is the way the story went about these guys. It was a weekend, and they were buzzing all over the compound about these two white soldiers that was caught in the act of being intimate. I don't know exactly what they were doing. I'm presupposing because someone said that they were in a bunk together, so they must have been making out. Okay, two U.S. soldiers. They obviously knew each other. They were discovered on a Sunday and turned in, and by Monday, I understand, their lockers had been cleared out, and they were cleared out. They got rid of them just that quick. It was a sin, I mean, in the worst way, to be caught, to have two men even talking with each other about that. You didn't do it. Now, and I remember it vividly because I had to shower every day. And I kept my eyes on myself, myself on myself. And if anybody was looking at me, I didn't know about it because I was just looking at me. I didn't look at nobody. You didn't have any pictures. You didn't have any correspondence with anyone like that. If it was going on in the Army, I wish somebody else would talk about it. I'm talking about it now. I didn't talk about it. I have pictures of me when I was there in the Army. I wasn't known as a gay guy, a sissy or a faggot that they used to call us guys like that. They didn't call me that. I was just John Coleman, soldier. I was a specialist fourth class in the 304th Signal Battalion, a radio teletype operator and a radio man during the Vietnam conflict. That is who and what I was. I didn't speak openly about my desires. As a matter of fact, a lot of the GIs would try to get me to go out with them when they went out on pass. They were going to go right across the street. They had a prostitution thing that GIs could go to. We called it Big Sue's Alley because it was like an alleyway. You would leave the compound and go down here, and Big Sue ran it. I don't know who she was, And I only went in there one time, and I went with a soldier. His name was Peterson. He was a white guy, and I was a black guy, and it was time for us to hit the veal, to go into Big Sue's Alley. Big Sue's Alley was, we had American doctors that gave the gals that worked in there vaccinations and shots to keep them clean from venereal disease, because American GIs would go in there. And I had never been in there, and I recall going in, okay? And I just didn't get along well with the women there. It didn't work. So I didn't have sex with anybody. But I heard about these two guys, these two soldiers, and they were caught doing something, and they were outed. I mean, their lockers were cleared out. They were no longer to be seen. They worked in they were caught in the area where the cooks, and the cooks had their own private sleeping quarters. They weren't out in the main hooch or barracks like I was. I slept in a compound that it was a long Quonset hut. I remember because it had two heaters in it. And during the winter, it got very cold in Korea. And so these heaters would heat up red hot, but it would keep that Quonset hut warm. I mean, American soldiers, we had it made back then. And I had my bed and my little, I had converted I forget what they call those things, where we would put our clothes. But it was a box that I had the houseboy, Mr. Park, bring me and had it painted white. And that's where I would have all of my private stuff that I bought, like my drinks, my soft drinks, my cigarettes, my candies, my crackers and cookies, and everything put in there. I even had a record player that I had my brother Ross send me from the States with a lot of my Motown records and albums. And a lot of the brothers from B Company came and met at my bed there, and we listened to the latest songs from back stateside, because the white boys were listening to their cowboy music and stuff like that, the Beach Boys and stuff like that. So I had the record player, Joe Foster, and all the other brothers would come by. And, I mean, I was at home with the brothers. I didn't hang out with gay guys because gay guys didn't hang out with gay guys. And those soldiers didn't know me as gay. I wasn't gay. I was John. And I was me. And if they knew that I was, they never said anything to me. I wish I could meet some of the guys. There's one guy that I am in contact with, I was in basics with. He lives in Chicago with Mario's help. I located him. And I never asked him if, because you didn't talk about that. You didn't say, did you know I was gay and stuff like that? Because you didn't talk like that. You just, they were your buddies. They were the guys that I was going to go to Vietnam with and die with. It was that kind of a thing. Being alive back there was like that. But I remember, I got to tell you how I felt. I felt terrified when it was discovered that those two white guys got caught, just, and they said, man, they were making out, and somebody caught them, and they told the MPs, and the MPs came and caught them in the act and arrested them and cleared out everything that they had and got rid of them. That's how bad it was. I mean, they would just get rid of us. The feeling that I felt was horrified. I knew I had to keep hidden my desires and who I was. It was well for me because my job, and I usually worked the midnight watch, I would have to take a not a taxi, but a Jeep down to the main camp. Sometimes I walked. Okay, I just left Camp Corner and walked over the hill to Yongsan. And in Yongsan, right over the hill, outside of Camp Corner, was the main 8th Army headquarters. That's where it was. And I had to work in a kind of like in a bunker thing to work my radio teletype. And Yongsan was the main base. And we had to keep field communications with about, I forget these guys, I Corps and Osan Air Base and other air bases. I was main communicator, and every hour on the hour, it was my duty to contact them on the radio and say, how do you read me? This is Yongsan, the headquarters of that. And they would come back and say loud and clear. They would come back and say loud and clear, you know, with the radio teletype. And every hour, we were supposed to communicate with these guys in every hour of the night in case South Korea was attacked by the North Koreans or the Chinese or the Vietnamese at that time. And it was a very serious job because the 8th Army was, you know, I have the insignias on my uniform. I got rid of the uniform a number of years ago. I should have held on to it. It would have been but I got rid of it all. My closet was filling up and I didn't need that. I have the memories in my mind. But it was like so swift they got rid of those gay guys. So swift that anybody else that was gay, you dare not say it. And trust me, there were some guys there in the 8th Army that I knew were like me. We were just hiding out. We didn't say anything. We didn't even speak to each other about who we really were. We just didn't. That was before the Stonewall Revolution in New York, and the other revolutions that took place later on in 67 and 68 and 69 in San Francisco, okay, the Castro District and all that, that didn't exist. And so you got to ask yourself this question. What was happening to all the gay people? Well, what was happening to them is what happened to me. I got out of the Army. I had to ask myself a very important question, you see. And I want to take a pause, time out, and say thank you to a friend of mine, Wayne Moody, who has become one of my dearest heartfelt friends. Me and Wayne speak with each other over FaceTime a lot, and we both have this white hair. He's from Belize, and I'm from Watts. And we laugh about us being gay and young and all of the struggles and trials that we went through, you know. And here it is, Memorial Day, and I'm talking about me being gay when I was in the Army. See, I was giving service to my country by protecting South Korea and the American 8th Army by being a radio teletype operator, and I could not express myself for who I was. I get out of the Army, and I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do to survive? You know, because I can't. And I said, well, the only women that I ever had any relations with in my life, that is, were Asian women, because it was in Korea where I lost my virginity, if you can call it that, because I really didn't. It's where it was the first time I just got naked with anybody, and didn't really flavor that at all with the women. And so I get out of the Army, and I say, well, I got to do something. I got to break out in this in this world of being normal and natural. That's why yesterday's webcast on being, I'll never go back to normalcy, because normalcy to me was a lie. And I'll never go back to lying to myself. I'm alive, I'm living, and it's great to be alive and to be able to speak about this. But I wasn't out it until after, long after I got out of the Army. Because when you're gay and you live in America, and back in the day, you had to make money, you had to survive, and being gay was criminal in a lot of people's mind. They were ashamed of it, literally ashamed of being who you were. And when I think about the number of people that died, in my worldview when AIDS came out, was that if you have sex with anybody that you're not married to, well, you deserve to get sick. That's how twisted my mind was back in the day, because I was terrified to have sex with anybody. I lived this life of pulling the shades down. When you listen to my preaching and my teaching, I still have an abrupt, real love for God and for what and who God was in my life and who God is in my life now. But I was sheltered with the shade pulled down. Was I fearful of coming out? No, I was fearful of not being. There were no people that you could talk to back in that day. They didn't have any counselors. They didn't have anybody that you could go to. They didn't have anybody that you could sit down and speak with. These young gay people now, they can talk with people. I'll tell you what I'm getting ready to start in my home. Thanks to my friend, Wayne Moody. Love drinking fresh water. It keeps my throat clear as well as my mind as I talk about these things, because these things have not been spoken about by me in years. And a lot of the people professionally that knew me would say, well, when John Coleman gay, you mean to tell me, was he gay when he was? Yes, I was, but I did not practice any kind of sexual practices outside of being with my wife while I was behind the pulpit, because I had utter respect for the people that I led, as well as I didn't know how to come out. It was just no way. It was just no way for me to come out and say, yeah, you know, I like guys more than I like girls. I mean, how do you say that? I like guys more than I like gals. I can say it now on my website in real time, because I live truth, my truth. As I said in yesterday's webcast, I do not allow anyone else's biases to affect me, because I don't live that person's lifestyle. And this is interesting. Let me share with you. Most of the men that I know, listen to this, you won't believe it. Most of the men that I know that are pastors, black men I'm talking about, that are pastors, have had multiple wives. Listen to me. Most of the men, multiple wives, are extreme sexual relations with the same or bisexuality and are adamantly preaching against homosexuality and their heterosexual behavior has been that of extreme whoredom and lasciviousness. Most men that I know that are pastors, very rarely do you find someone with a history like I had, because I wasn't out there touching nobody. I was preaching the truth of God's word, had one woman, 35 years, and of that 35 years of being with her, I had no other women, no secret rendezvous, no weekends out of town, none of that. And most of the preachers that I know that are dead and some alive lived a life of whoredom. Now, I don't know why that is, but when God called me, he didn't call me. That's why I try to tell people. And I hope that you can listen through to my webcast, because as I give these webcasts, day by day, I'm going to be giving you more truth talk, because I want you to talk truth talk to yourself. I want you to be who you are and to live the life that you are. And I am especially reaching out to my young gay brothers. And all this psychology. Man, you guys, look, I got to have a special webcast to tell you that the church had once a thing where they could put you in gay therapy and talk you out of that. Can't nobody talk you out of the nature of who you are. That is the stupidest thing that I've ever heard in my life. And when they had that kind of stuff, most of the guys that got into those programs, a lot of white guys went into those programs. Southern Baptist was hot as hell on that issue. They couldn't deal with homosexuality. And it's in every nationality on the globe. It's in every religion conceivable that you can think of. And it's going to be until the world is no longer, because we have always been here. And in the American, man, I can really laugh about this. This is some funny stuff. And in the American superstructure, we have conjured up so many ways to hide and to inhibit anyone from knowing who we are. And I believe that it's that way because a lot of people in the life that I have always been a part of are abominable snowmen. Meaning that we have to stop coercing these young gay people into being what our perverse, destituted minds have led us into. You can listen. I am going to start, and I got to tell you guys this is the first time that you're going to hear it, because I have been wrestling. Oh, I got to talk about it. Because I want everything to come out. I want everything to come out about me. I have been saying over the years, I agree with, because I go to the pride parades. I go to all that, and I'm happy that everybody's free to now we can take off our mask and be around people. I'm going to still leave mine on because, you know, it's still rough, tough, and tactical out there. So I'm not sold out on all that. But here recently, I just recently gotten sold on same-sex marriage. And now, I know the Bible says about a man and a woman coming together, but I'm not talking about that kind of marriage. I'm talking about what marriages constitute in this country. Marriages between a man and a woman constitutes an idealism that I'm living off of right now. I married Lucy. My job was a City of L.A. job. that I didn't pour into my Social Security. My wife's job provided Social Security for her. I took the retirement of my job because I've always believed that Jehovah Jireh, that God would supply all of my needs. That's what I believe by reading the Bible. And God has done it thus far. But she had Social Security, I didn't. And I am living off of the Social Security that she left for me. See, that was the benefit of me being married to her for 35 years, loving her as a husband would love a wife. And God bless her. She gave me two beautiful daughters that we had together from her flesh and my flesh. And I loved it. And that is why I admonish a lot of gay men today that want to have children. If you can find a woman that can love you enough, that can have a child with you and bless you with being a father, do that. Do that. But love that woman and respect that woman in every area that you can. But if you cannot get along with that woman that you had that child with, you take care of that child and that woman's life and respect her. And then if you marry another man, you should be able to get the benefits of a true marriage as if you married a woman, since you're living with that man in true love for that man. I just came to that idea maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it solidified because I see that in this country, in the environment that I come from, marriage is an agreement for you to see to that person's life even after your life is over. And that is a wonderful thing. And so I'm looking at my life in a way that will bring honor, not only honor to it, but a kind of, what can I say? Justification of life. Because I'm still alive. And now, how am I going to help the community of which I am a part? Okay, I am not going to deny that I realize where all my brothers and sisters are coming from that think like me, and even the ones that are not gay but are sympathetic towards how we live and feel because of my offspring and the friends that I have and the acquaintances that I will run into for the rest of my life. I don't know whether I'm going to break the news to you right now. My house is being painted. They stopped this weekend because of the holiday. But thanks to Wayne Moody, I'm going to call it not Harcourt House anymore, but The Oasis, because it'll be painted green. And I'm going to set up my patio room. I told you about my garden out there in the back. I'm already, as a matter of fact, today is a perfect day. Once I finish doing the webcast, I'm going to start planting some of my seeds. I want to go to the 99-cent store and get these little sticks and these little signposts, and so I can document the vegetables and the fruits that I'm planting in my backyard. And within a year, this is the vision that I have, within a year, if God is willing, please let me live that I can keep Harcourt House open and it can become an oasis for someone to find life, to come and have discussions of it. I have so many marriage counseling formats, right? I am going to develop some marriage counseling formats. All my PowerPoints and everything will be aimed at people that want to marry and love each other, gay or straight. I'm going to remove the bias classification of male or female there, because we're talking about being with someone that you can love. And how do you get with a person that you can love and make sure that that person is right for you. I recall when I was doing marriage counseling as a pastor in the church, and I'm going to tell you, I would have those guys and gals sat before me, and I'd ask some questions, and I could see the devastation in the lives that would take place because that was just a business agreement. That wasn't love. That wasn't love. I don't know why I was so foolish to think that because I love Lucy that way, that every other man should love their women in that way. I don't know why I believe that. I don't know why anyone would believe that. Check it out. If you love the person that you are with, whether that person is male or female, if you love that person and want to be dedicated to taking care of that person's life, cooking dinner for that person, washing clothes, mopping the floor for them, I don't care if you are same sex, a different sex, you have a right as an adult cognitively thinking about what you're doing and how you're doing it, not to follow a group of people that will put you on a path of insane. Listen, when I got out of the Army, somebody said to me, well, John, you're going to find one of these nice young African-American girls here to marry so you can have. And I remember one girl, I took her out on a date. Her name started with an L. I won't say her name because she still may be alive. And I remember after going, there used to be a very popular restaurant on the corner of that was La Brea Avenue and what was that? Rodeo Road. Used to be a big pink restaurant, a classical restaurant, because I remember the night that I took this gal to the restaurant. I was in my early 20s. I had to be 19 or 20. Sometime before or after I got out of the Army, I took her to this restaurant, and she asked me how many children I wanted. And I said, oh, I thought about that. And this was a black woman talking to me. And I said, no more than two. She said, why two? I said, because they're going to need somebody to play with. Because I'll be too busy working. And I presupposed that the mother would be working because we have to be buying us a house to live in and so we could live happily, because I'm not going to live in an apartment all my life. That's what I told this woman. And she said, ooh, how about if you married me? And I looked at her, and the first thing that popped in my mind, I said, I don't want to have no babies with her. No, no, because I knew her brothers, and they were some ugly scoundrels. She lived right across the street from where I was raised, in my grandmother's house, okay? All right? And that was the last time I went out on a date with her or had a discussion with her about something as serious as marriage, because I sure enough did not want to talk about marrying somebody that I didn't like the way they looked and I didn't like their cultural things. Because, see, man, my house got to be clean. My house is clean now. My house got to remain clean. My house got to be clean. I can't be having your in-laws come by. I don't even have my in-laws come by my house. I had a serious discussion with a cousin of mine, and she said, Junie, why didn't you ever allow us to come by your house when you married Lucy? I said, because there were certain ways that I wanted to live, and I wanted my life to be. And, you know, that's the same way now. I have certain guys come by my house. I don't mind them coming by. I like other guys coming by my house more than these rowdy ghetto brothers, because these ghetto brothers come by and tear your place up, make you want to pull your gun out. But I knew then, just like I know now. So I'm going to start counseling couples. I'm going to rework my marriage counseling format. And those of you that don't like the direction that I'm going in, like I said on yesterday's webcast, you can find your field and go plowing in that field and plant your grain wherever you are. And let's see what God is going to bless. Because I'm telling you, I did right by God by what I was doing when I was in that ministry. I never defaced God or did anything to bring shame to God. It was a word of God that went forth. But I am not going to push an agenda that I know will not work. Don't ever tell a gay man that he should try to be more happier with a woman if he is inclined to tell you that he has no desire to be with one. And trust me, I tell you why I got with one, because of the field that I was in. I knew that without having a wife, I'd never be successful as a Christian pastor during the time of my life in the late 60s and the early 70s, having children and going through the 80s and the 90s when my children grew up and became adults and went away to college and then transitioning on into this new century of millennials and everything else. Now, I'm still alive and alive until I'm not alive. Now, what am I going to do? I'm going to start living like a man that's alive and stop living like I'm waiting on some rapturous event to come and take me out of here because I don't like the world that I live in. That's what I see the church as. If God has given you life in this life now, live it with the life that you're in. That's receiving the blessings of God. And stop listening to someone else's agenda if that agenda has played out. Play in to where God has you right now. And stop thinking with the past, because when you think with the mind of the past, you won't last today. You can't do it. You cannot do that. There it is. And so the Oasis is a dream coming to fulfillment. I want to thank my friend Wayne Moody for putting it there, because I was wondering what I was going to call my house, because I'm painting it green. I'm ordering a new front entry door. It should be arriving at my house, Lord willing, sometime next week. When I get a little bit more money, I'm going to one by one change all of the windows in the house, have the windows change, and then with my garden growing and have everything fresh and green and delicious, do you know what? It is going to be a blessing to the myriads of people that come my way. Thank you for coming to my website today on this June the 1st, 2021. This is, that's right, your internet pastor. Hey, not some new wave pastor, not some new crazy corny doctrine. Stay on my website and scroll down and listen to some of the sermons that I preached years ago. I haven't changed from that. I just rolled the shade up. You need to know who I am, what I stand for, where I'm headed, where I'm going. You don't have to like me. You don't have to back me. I want you to respect what I'm saying as a human being. And if you don't, I'm going to respect you. And I'll check you out from time to time. God bless you. thank you for being my friend.